Eternal
So hello and welcome to episode 1 of season 2 of the Carpcast Extra. How are we doing, Mark?
Oh, episode 1, season 2, that sounds so American.
Well, season 2, episode 1, I should say. Season 1, if you haven't heard it already, I'm sure you have if you've all subscribed for the year, but that is available to download as a package if you're just listening to this as a package itself. Who are the anglers we've got? Who are our name celebrities that are going to be entertaining you with their stories during this sequence of episodes, this series, I should say? Who have we got, Mark?
Oh, we've got a real bunch of not just great anglers, but great storytellers. We've got Adam Penning, yes. Ian Chilly Chilcott, Ian Russell, and a third Ian McMillan, Steve Briggs, and Lee Jackson.
Jacko, yes, I spoke to Lee Jacko, yes. Jackson at length recently. We've got him. It's amazing the history that chap's got. I mean, he caught his first carp. Well, no, he caught his first significant carp in 1972, the year I was born. He had a 24 pounder. I think my first 20 probably came in about 1990 something. It just shows what a big carp that was for the year.
Well, yeah, that is even before the accident that produced me.
Of course it is. I'm a little bit older. So just like season one, we ask our guests a number of questions to get some stories out of them. And as we did in season one, we're going to start off with their greatest achievement. Now, on the first lot, we gave our own greatest achievements, didn't we, Mark? So we can't do that again. But what's your most recent achievement, would you say? Something that you that you consider right up there?
Ooh, I've not really done anything this year that I consider right up there. But yeah, my most recent session, I've kind of crossed that threshold where I'm thinking I've got this lake. I've caught a few. I've got it not sussed, but I'm in the right direction. The cogs are ticking. The plans are coming, and I had a 23 and a 32 on my last session, and I was quite pleased with that. It was also pleasing to see there's an old fella called Clive Fish in there. I think he's gone about 5 weeks without a bite, and I photographed a 35 for him as well. So not just the lake switching on, I'm giving my share, and several fish that over the magic 4-0 figure. So I'm itching. So tell me about yours. Have you done anything this year that you consider a great achievement?
I had
a does it involve the cops?
Yeah, I had a fantastic start to the year, didn't I? So I've waited. Yeah. I've waited. I've been with Nash maybe 12, 13 years, something like that. Around 12 years, I think. Maybe even longer, actually. Was it 2002 we fished on pit 2?
It will be 15 years for you.
Will it? Wow.
Yeah, because I left 2 years back. And I was 12 years, and you were just before me.
Right, so I've been with Nash 15 years. I originally was introduced by Dave Levy to get on the bait, and the Scopet squid was huge at the time. And I went down there to meet everybody, and then didn't have a lot to do for the first couple of years except for catching fish and you know, putting stuff in the papers and just ordering bait and stuff. I developed a relationship, came pretty friendly with Alan Blair, who's a top guy, you know, been out a few times at shows and drum and bass raves and stuff. And then obviously got a bit closer and got the opportunity to fish on the Church Lake, which is probably the most well known of Kevin's two lakes, the two named lakes. He's also got the office lake as well, and he's now dug a new one next door, in the field next door, which is going to be his new Copse Lake, really his own personal lake. He's got one in his actual house, which is next door in the back garden as well, but that's a different one. Anyway, so the Church and the Copse are the two main ones. I think I fished the Church three or four times, most of those being in winter, apart from the one first session. And every time to get to the Church, you have to walk past the Copse. The Copse is a bit smaller. It's about just under 2 acres, I would say, with two like cigari type islands up the middle. Quite intimate fishing, and I knew it had a large amount of 50 pound fish, and at the time it had a good 60. And every time I fished the Church, I would walk past the Copse, and because the Church is like higher up and there's like a wooden cabin between the two lakes, and you could stand off the veranda on the wooden cabin at the top and you could see, like, you're high up, it's like being up a tree but looking over the Church, over the Copse, sorry, and I would see those massive fish in there every single time. And I dearly wanted to fish that lake. The thought crosses your mind, you know, could I just sneak on tonight and catch a fish? And you could easily, yeah, because nobody was fishing it in those days. Nobody at all. Kevin had fished three or four sessions a year with one of his friends, Nigel, by the way, or someone, and that was it. It was just mainly feeding them, trying to grow them as big as possible. And yeah, I could have sneaked on it at night, and I maybe could have caught a fish fairly easy, I don't know, but it's just not worth the risk. It's not, you know, it's not worth being ostracized from Nash. You could never show the picture to anybody. Like, this is just a pointless capture. Like, it'd mean nothing. But that didn't stop you looking over and seeing fish of mammoth proportions. Bear in mind, you know, you knew you were looking at 50s or 60s. There was nothing small in there. He took them out. I think at one point at its peak there was probably 22 fish in there, and I think almost half of them were 50s or 60s at its absolute peak. And you would see these fish clear as day. You know, I could see them feeding in certain areas. There was a corner spot with a hump. And the dream was always, I want to fish this lake one time. And Kevin was very protective over it for a number of years. He said, oh, I'll be opening the Copse next year. You know, you'll get a chance. And he must have said that to me five times over 5 years, you know, and it never opened and nobody ever got to fish it. And eventually, he opened it, which was this year. He was opening it to the public, and he allowed Alan Blair to fish on there last year, which would have been 2015. Alan had free run on it, and he caught quite a few fish, including the good 60 died this year. There was like a mid 60 in there, which is the one Mark Holmes caught many years ago off the top on a floater at 61, I think, or 60 in ounces. That unfortunately died, or they think it's dead. And there's two other upper 50s. One is a common known as the Emperor, which was the big long common that Kevin's been pictured with on the front of an old catalogue many, many years ago, good 10, 15 years ago. And the other one's called the Wood Carving, which has come through, which is now £59, which will probably do 60 this winter. It's a cracking looking fish. I would dearly love to catch that fish. So I've watched these fish on the odd times I've been allowed on the Church. I've watched these fish for 15 years, so to have a chance to finally be able to fish for them, I was allowed on in January of this year, of 2016, and so excited, got the lake to myself. The wind was bashing in, it was mild, and the wind was bashing in to the end of the lake. So I set up there. I flicked my right hand rod out in a pretty obvious looking area to the right. It was like a little bay to my right, and it was quite weedy. It was a fair bit of weed about because we'd had a mild winter, but I found like a hard sort of clay spot. I don't know, maybe size of half a brolly, that sort of size. It was only like an underarm, you know, like 2-3 rod lengths or something. And the wind was really pushing in, and it was right in front of where the air aerator pump is situated as well, which is obviously they've had the aerator on a lot of times over the winter, and I just felt like there would be fish there. It just looked perfect. It was on the wind. I flicked that rod out. I started finding the spot for my second rod. I got my second rod out, and by the time I started doing a third rod, the right hand rod had gone. The first spot that I'd found, the really nice hump, and I was like, I was hooked into a copslake fish within, I mean, it's probably only within 20 minutes of actually fishing. I've probably been on the complex 2 hours and, you know, getting the bivvy set up and getting everything sorted, and the rod had been out 20 minutes, if that, maybe 15. And I was into a chunk. I landed it fairly easily, no major dramas. It went over the net cord. I picked the net up, and you know when you just look down at a big fish in there, I just picked the net up. I could see this huge width of a back, and I thought, that's a 40. So the first thing I thought is, that's a 40, which, you know, I mean, a 40 is a significantly large carp. It looks, you know, it looks a chunk bigger than the majority of carp that you catch, because obviously it is. And then in the back of my mind, I was like, that's upper 40. It's definitely upper 40. It's a chunk. I rung Alan. He was laughing down the phone. He went, Classic's only been on 15 minutes. He's got one. He's got a chunk in the net. I could hear him shouting to the rest of the office. And down they came. Kevin came down, a couple of lads, to video it. Everybody laughing because they couldn't believe it. Mick Henderson had been fishing the previous couple of weeks, and he'd had a few, but none of the big ones. I think he'd had fish to like 30 pound. He had one of the really pretty ones, and a few of the fish that are bred in there, there's quite a few mid-20s in there that are bred that only ever get caught once. They take them out when they get caught, so they never get caught a second time. But he'd been catching a few of them, and apart from that, he'd fish pretty slow all winter. And bish bosh, they couldn't believe it that I'd just had a big one. And it went 51 pound on the scales, and I'll tell you what, that felt pretty good for January. I mean, it doesn't stop there, the story continues, because I went back. I was allowed to go on again at the end of February, and it took 3 days to catch one of the A team. But I did. I caught another three or four fish, and I had another one of the 50s, not quite 50, I think it was like high 48s, something like that. But it was one of the, what Kevin calls his 80. I think there's five 50 pluses in there now, including this. Well, it's not actually been 60 yet, the wood carving. There's five, maybe six 50 pluses. And I'd had one of those five. Very pretty fish. I forget what they call it now. They call it the DVD fish because it's on. Kevin braces it with another 50 on. Is he fishing off the top or on zigs? I can't remember. In the
final chapter, is it?
In the final chapter DVD, yeah. They it's known as the DVD fish, which Kevin caught. I had that at like high 48s. And I tell you what, you know, we're not into March yet, and I've had two of the A team out of the Copse Lake. And that felt like a pretty good achievement. I mean, you know, it's a tricky lake, that Copse Lake. It's been open to the general public this year, and most people have blanked. I think out of the people that have paid to fish that lake this year, there's only a couple of them caught all year. It is tricky. It's small lake tricky. So I think your best chance of catching is in the first 24 hours when you get on the lake, and after that the fish just shut up shop like they do on small lakes. They get a bit scared as soon as they know you're fishing for them, and they just don't eat. So it felt like a good achievement. Yes, you know, the lake's not been heavily fished, but it had been fished every week over the winter up until that point where I got on there, so it did feel like an achievement. You know, Mick Henderson's a very good angler, and he hadn't had any of the big ones. I had a couple, so you can't choose what picks your bait up. You know, people have said to me, especially Jacko, in the conversations I had with him, you know, he strongly believes you can't pick the fish. It's there's a bit of luck involved. I don't know if I completely agree with that, because I have got an abnormally decent record of large carp. You know, for numbers caught, I do tend to get amongst the A team on every lake fairly quickly. Don't know if you think there's anything in that, Mark, or if I'm just a lucky bar steward.
Oh, you're definitely a lucky bar steward. But I think when you speak to people, when you hear, you know, Gary Bayes talk about the key, you look at the results of Crowy, they're the same in a few other baits that are just known as big fish baits. You know, there's only so much you can put down to coincidence. And do you think your female pheromones help?
Yeah, maybe I'm effeminate. But, I don't know. Anyway, let's get on and let's see what Adam Penning considers his greatest achievement.
Right, okay. My greatest carping achievement would probably be... It's really difficult because you when you get asked what your most significant or most memorable capture is, I'm not one of those that go, oh, there's so many, all that bollocks, because there probably isn't. But there's a couple of notable ones, and you always sit there and it kind of like you tell one or you think of one and then a few weeks later your mood changes and you get a bit reflective on something else. And I was thinking about this earlier and I thought, although my first 20 was hugely significant, and I think I did that as a catch of a lifetime story for Joe at Carp TV, and it was monumental for me. You know, that was just made such a big impression on me seeing that in the net. But I think probably when it comes down to biggest achievement, would probably be my first 40-pound carp, purely because of what I was up against to try and catch it. And also because ostensibly it was an unknown 40-pound carp, which has always been a bit rarefied and sort of special. So I was fishing a small lake on the other side of the country. I was working for Peter Drennan and running the ESP brand. And I'd got into this little lake out in Hampshire, so it was a bit of a trot. It was not particularly big, couple of islands, but it had a very, very low stock. There were exactly 10 carp, which later went on to be 9. And it was very, very weedy, gin clear, and I had seen a fish get caught out of there by a friend of a friend a few years before, and it went 36 pounds, and it was a really, really long, leany looking fish, quite spectacular. And I decided it was going to become my mission to try and catch this fish, because I'd only ever known that it had been caught a couple of times, and it was so incredibly long and powerful looking and dark, and it just captivated me. And I also thought in the back of my mind, because it hadn't been caught for a couple of years, and because normally I take a little bit of time to winkle them out before I work out what's going on, because I'm a bit thick, by the time I get round to catching it, if I was lucky enough to, it could be maybe massive. You know, it was getting bigger. Every capture it had done had been bigger. So a couple of years with no captures, and then, you know, figure in my the time it was going to take me to catch it, because I didn't think I was going to catch it quick, because it was such a tricky lake. I thought, yeah, this could be really exciting. So I fished for this fish, and over a period of 18 months or so, I managed to account for all the other fish in the lake apart from this one. One of which was incredibly special, because it was a really incredibly dark purple, dark red mirror, which went just a touch under 39 pounds, and he had not been caught for 7 years. So that was a massive, massive thing. But I couldn't get this big one, and started to, you know, when you start getting recaptures out of a stock of only 10 fish, you think, well, all you have to do is you just carry on going. And we probably all had these conversations where you start questioning what you're doing. You know, was it one of the ones I lost? Well, almost definitely it probably was one of the ones I lost. And then you think, well, if I lost it, should I change bait? Is he going to pick it up again? And you start questioning things. But ultimately, I was catching fish with reasonable regularity, you know, maybe one a month or something like that. And the answer is always just to keep doing what you're doing as long as you're catching. So that's what I ultimately did. And But what I didn't factor in was changing jobs. And sort of about 18 months into the campaign, I got headhunted by a tackle company in Essex. And some of you might have heard of them, called Corda. And they made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, basically, to leave Drennan, stroke ESP, and come across and work for them. So after a bit of nefarious meetings and so on, I decided to go on board, which meant relocating back to Essex. Do you know what? I've actually messed that story up. That was the second time I got headhunted. I apologise. The first, this was actually Cliff Fox and Max Cottis. So this was when I went to join Fox. So they lured me away from ESP with a promise of a good salary, which was going to give me a chance to get on the property ladder, which I really wanted to do because I wasn't earning much money. So I've moved back across to Essex and started working there. And of course, once you're neck deep in a proper campaign, a proper mission where you've had blood, sweat and tears, you've given everything to try and catch the fish out of this lake, you know, and they were very, very, everyone was so hard won that by the time you've done that for a period of time and you haven't got your reward, if you walk away from it, it's almost like all of that, it wouldn't have been wasted because I had a fantastic time on there, but it needed to be finished. So I then decided, well, I don't think it was even an issue. I think it was all, I always took it for granted that I was just going to carry on fishing there. So as soon as I got to Essex, every time I finished work on a Friday night, Friday afternoon, try and get off a couple of hours early if I could, I would trek from Hainault in Essex all the way round to the lake in Hampshire, which was a round trip of about 120 miles, not a round trip, it was about 120 miles to get there, so it's 240 round trip. But so I would go around there, get there sort of Friday evening, fish for these fish, and so it went on, and then it went into the winter. I caught, it wasn't a very good winter water at all, it was very deep, very weedy, and obviously with a ridiculously low stock. And so the next significant thing that happened was, in the spring. Now this was 2006, and, it was spring, as I said, and I had been watching the fish showing on really frosty mornings. But bear in mind, up until this point, not only had I been fishing it most weekends, but quite often on a Wednesday night, I would go and bait up. So I'd drive 120 miles there, pump up the boat, go out in the boat, do the bucket of hemp and some Grange red boilies I was using at the time. And that was that. And so, yeah, it was a lot of mileage, this is ultimately, well, the reason for telling you all this is why I figure it's probably my greatest achievement, because it was a huge amount of effort and desire. And I really, you know, you think, could this fish really come? Well, other people were fishing the lake and no one had caught it, no one had seen it, but no one else was really catching anything, which sort of, again, sort of ploughed me on in the knowledge that I must be doing something right. And caught a couple of floaters and a couple over big beds of hemp pre-baited and so on, you know, different things. But generally, you just had to follow them around and then get your traps set as quietly as possible. But so it's come to the spring, and I'd seen the fish showing in this in one particular zone, dead in line with one particular tree, about centre of the lake. And I figured that if I moved around and fished it from the opposite bank, then I'd be able to get lines to it. So I did, and the following session I caught a common, which was another recapture. It was a low 20, beautiful old fish. And I've just seen a carp roll just behind my spot. That's nice. Excellent. It's a bit of a distraction. I forgot what I was saying. So that was a big, he came out and I saw the underside of his chin. It was like a white triangle. Got quite a good fish. So I've started figuring that I'm going to attack this area. And so I had probably 3 or 4 kilos, of, maybe 5 kilos of Grange Red with me left over. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go and just put, because I was catching a few tench and there was some really big tench in there. I thought, I'm just going to go and put boilies in. It was still cold. It was early April. And probably the last day of March when I did it. And I just drifted down the centre of the lake over this spot and just spread the boilies over this area. And then went home. And then I came back the following weekend, which was the 7th of April. And I fanned the rods out. I put 2 on a spot where I caught this, a few tench and this 20-pound common. And I thought I'd put the other one a little bit further down to my left. And I did one, I remember it vividly. I did one cast, and it was a Grange Red cork bore on a stiff hinge. And I mean, back, the people weren't really using stiff hinges much then. It was a proper weapon in your armory. And I remember I cast it. There was a tree in the bottom corner in the lake near the island. I cast it. It wasn't near the tree. The tree was my horizon marker. And in my mind, I thought, it's just got to land about there. That'll be about where the boilie trail finished, where I spread them from the boat. And I remember I cast it, and it landed on the water perfectly, and it went down with an unbelievable crack, probably about 65 yards out. And the lake is very, very weedy even at that time of year. So I thought, bloody hell, that was a result. I was expecting to cast around a bit. So night was very quiet. There was a bit of frost, freezing cold. And the next morning, I was sat there on my bed chair under the Evo, and I was thinking, another blank night. You know, it was par for the course, really. But I started to think, you know, every spring you got fearful that there was going to be a load of new faces turn up, and you were really fearful that someone else was going to catch it before you were. And you're thinking, now this fish had not been out for probably 3 years or more, and it could be massive. I thought I'd seen it a couple of times, and just this huge dark shape down deep. And the stakes were quite high in my mind, even though I was still only sharing the lake with a couple of people at this time. And I was really fretting. And I remember sitting there on the bed chair thinking, right, I'm going to have to get my sounder box and go off and check a few spots that I've been priming in the little bays and up the margins and that. I'll just make a cup of coffee. Kettle's gone on, and just at that moment my left hand rod that cracked down on that cast wrenched round and flew. I always fish with quite tight clutches, so it was quite a surprisingly violent, and it's flown, and I was only sat 3 or 4 foot from the rod, so I picked it up. And the first thing that you always thought when you hooked a carp on there was, oh my god, I've hooked a bloody carp. And you look out over your spot to see if there's any swans out there. Then you think, oh, is there any? You're bent into a carp and you're looking for something because it seems so incredible that you've hooked one. You think, oh, is it a swan gone through my line, or is a coot? Obviously, a coot is never going to pull line if you reel, but you do. You're so shocked to have hooked one. And there I was, lent into this fish. And after 10 seconds and it's chugging away, you think, oh my God. And you start talking to yourself, it's a carp. I've hooked another carp. Bloody hell, I've got a carp. Right, I've got to get in. Please, please, God, please come in. And this fish is absolutely flat rodding me down to the left. It's gone about 120 yards down to the left, and I couldn't do anything with it. It was remarkable. And then I saw the line cutting across the surface where the fish had gone all the way down the lake, and then he decided to just charge in towards this reed bed that was down my back, further down the bank I was on, with a couple of snag trees between me and it. I could see the line cutting in, and I was thinking, no, and there's nothing I could do. And you put maximum side strain on, and you really lean into it, and it just turned before the reeds. And I remember all the coots in the reeds going absolutely crazy and all taking flight and shrieking. And I thought, oh my God, what have they just seen come up to them? And then it turned and it went out. Anyway, this fish I had on for in the region of 45 minutes. I just never experienced anything like it. And it went up and down, and then it went up around a willow to my right, and then it went along the top of a bar, and I thought I saw it, and eventually I'm out in the water now in waders, and eventually you're starting to think, this is it. This must be it. I caught all the others, and nothing had felt like this. And I got the fish in close, and then I saw it go past the rod tip in this tap clear water, and could just see it was massive. And it's hard to explain how you feel, but you're terrified, obviously, is the main emotion, and apprehensive. And eventually I got the leader up, and I mean, 45 minutes is a long, long fight in anyone's book, and I was just exhausted mentally and emotionally, and I eventually managed to draw this fish over the net, and I got it in. And then I took a deep breath, and I just waded out and looked down into the mesh, and instantly knew I was just looking at something that was Now a carp's just jumped out. Sorry, it's just launched himself right. And I just instantly knew that I was looking at the king of the lake, this hugely long mirror carp. And anyway, I secured the fish, and then I got everything sorted, the mat and the scales and everything. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, wow, that looks big. So 39 pound. Could it be? Could it possibly be like, you know, an unknown 40 pounder or something? And so I've got everything sorted out, and then I've carried it to the mat, and then I've realised, my God, this is like carrying a sack of potatoes. And I laid it down, and it's just had this cavernous, unblemished, enormous mouth. And my size 4 was neatly in the middle of the bottom lip. I unhooked it, plucked a few leeches off him, and then put him in the sling, and lifted him up on the zero digital scales, and he went 40 pound 10 ounces, which was just more than I could ever have dreamt. Or I had dreamt about it. I'd lived it over and over in my mind what it would be like to catch this fish. The fact that it was over that mark as well, which just made it even more incredible. And so I put it in a sack, and rung some friends, and my best mate Mark drove all the way from Essex to do some pictures for me, and a couple of other guys came down, and I remember being at the end of it when I'd finished holding this creature for the pictures, and I let it swim out of my hands. I was totally overcome with emotion, like my eyes filled up with tears, and I just sat in the edge of the margin, covered in mud and weed, in my chest waders, and I looked out at the lake, and I thought, my God, I'm never coming back. I've had my greatest angling achievement, and it's, to this day, it's a fish that I've never publicised or written about or put a picture up anywhere of. I've just kept it sort of special for me, and yeah, that was probably against the odds, and my greatest angling achievement.
Did you enjoy that, Mark?
Oh, I certainly did. I enjoyed the several hours I spent on with Adam Penning, all his stories, and it's almost like when you're listening to them, you just become so engrossed with such a great storyteller like that, and you kind of forget you're there recording them and you're actually doing a job. It's almost so much fun.
Yeah, but, all the interviews I did, I had a smile on my face just listening to people tell these stories. You know, it's, you can see them enjoying them doing it as well, because it's bringing back memories, and it's quite nice, I think.
Yeah, a few have said that to me afterwards. You know, Chili did, I think Steve Briggs did as well, when he was recalling his Black Mirror story for the main interview, that you know, it just brought so many things back. And now, speaking of Chili, shall we get him in next for his achievement story?
Let's get Mr. Chilcott.
What do I consider to be my greatest achievement in carp fishing? I don't know. I think enjoying the whole experience, not being overly competitive, not, you know, trying to use any of my results to make me better than anybody else, but just simply enjoying it. In terms of fish and fishing, I think probably one of my greatest or probably the greatest fish. It weighed 29 pounds and 12 ounces and came from a lake in Middle England. I'm not even going to mention its name, and there were so few fish in it. I caught two tiny little commons from it, real old cricket bats, and this really dark old mirror of 29 pounds and 12 ounces. And to this day, I still think that's probably the greatest carp I've ever caught.
It's nice to see that it's not always about the biggest fish. You know, your greatest achievement doesn't have to be the biggest carp you ever caught, which I can think of fish I've caught out of really hard, low stock lakes, and it doesn't matter how big that first one is. You know, if you remember that the 19 pounders out of St. Ives Lagoon used to be, you know, to feel as good as catching anything out there because you worked so hard for every bite, didn't you?
Yeah, my first fish from there, it was more in shock than anything else. It was a real out the blue sort of. I think you'd accuse me of having the wobbles the day before. When I'm, you know, with confidence is waving a bit, and I remember it well because I was actually up to my knees in the water picking all the bits of Canadian off the lines that had drifted onto it, and then the rod just ripped off to the left of me, and you look at it, you think, bloody hell, I better deal with that. Wow, he's done. And it was a common, just under 22 pound, and it was wow. Same with my first ever fish from Elstow too, which I know we talk about it a lot on the main podcast, but that fish was a breakthrough moment for me. It was my first fish since I started travelling. It came after only 7 nights on there, and it was wow, I can catch these fish. There's nothing stopping me now.
Yeah. You
know? It was a breakthrough, and I still look back at that picture, a fish called the Sausage, and it brings a smile to my face every time.
Let's see what Ian McMillan's greatest achievement is.
My greatest carping achievement, man alive. There's been quite a few. I suppose I've got a couple of things, a couple of answers, but if it's basically on fish or weights, I've gone years and years and years where my PB was 35.5 pounds, which is a fish called Jordan from Hardwick, down on the Linear Complex, and it was only three lakes, and probably a lot of people don't even realise that it was only three lakes at Linear years ago. And it stood for ages and ages. And then I progressed and got a Welly ticket, which was in 2005. And obviously back then there was loads of 30s and probably half a dozen 6 or 8 40s. And you kind of think, well, I'd like to beat my PB. So I did the summer and I did the autumn, and I had fish at a common as well, up to 39.50, and I thought, oh God, you know, I'd love to catch a 40-pounder. Because you, as much as it shouldn't be about the weight, you always set yourself a target or of a weight. And I had this common at 39.50, and it was so close that Mike Wilmot was on the way with his son on a guest, an official guest, not a poaching guest, that is. And I rung Dave Fu, as you then rung him, because I was delirious. I thought, my God, he's so close, and I was shaking like a shitting dog, and I couldn't get the scales right. And so he came round, and it was 39.15, and I was still over the moon, but oh God, I've got to get a 40-pounder. So the following spring, the fish are putting more weight on, and did a few 40s coming out. And then I used to get to the lake on a Thursday afternoon after I'd finished work for Tracker. Conveniently, I would always be within half an hour to shop, within the radius of Wellington. And so I fuzzed the rods out, and I had a bite. I'm sort of playing it in, not really thinking anything of it, and quite sizable fishes has gone in the net. And so I've got all the weighing gear ready, as you do, and no one else about. So I put it on scales, and it's gone round, it's gone past 40, and I'm thinking, oh, shit. And it settled on, I think it was 40.10 pounds. And I'm looking around and almost thinking that I sort of need a Jeremy Kyle audience here to give me a big round of applause, because after all these years, I've finally done it. And it was real surreal feeling that no one was there. And it probably meant more the fact that I'd done it and no one was there to celebrate it. And then, so I put the fish in a sack, because it was before the days of retainers, and I thought, I'll set myself take gear up and I'll sort of do that. And then Wade has appeared in the swim, and I'm sort of a bit delirious, and he's going, what's up? I said, I've got a 40 pound in the slack. I said, it's my first 40 pound, and I'm sort of waffling a load of shit. And he's dead chilled. He's like, all right then, boy, get it out of the sack. Let's do some pictures. And I've still got it now. And it was a proper old brute of a fish. And it sort of didn't... You know, I suppose it's a bit like when you lose your virginity and you finally manage to let the contents of your ball bag out of its socket for that very first time. And we all remember it. And we all, I suppose all through your teenage years, because I was 16, you think, I want it to be memorable. I want to be a porn star. I want to go forever. When in reality, it's like 20 seconds done. And it was a bit like that when I had this 40 pounder. It wasn't an anticlimax, but it almost was, because I thought it would be like a massive drum roll. And I thought, it's going to change my life. It's going to make me a better angler. Do you know what? It didn't, because it was just another carp, and it just happened to be 11 ounces bigger than a 39-15 that I caught before. So, I mean, that was my first 40 pounder. And I haven't always set targets. I've always wanted... or achievements. I've never hoped to achieve anything. I just sort of fished for fish, and the natural progression after that was to want to catch a 40 pound common, because I thought, well, I've been within an ounce. I drifted off from Welling, and I went to Frimley, caught loads of carp, and I was pre-baiting in the week in a very unfancied swim, but I did think, I'm not going to catch a 40 pounder from this side of the bar. A lot of the big fish always used to come from the double board, so it was coming into autumn, and I thought, right, I've got to change the plan of attack. So I've gone around to the double boards. I did my first session, I had a couple to mid-30s, and then I was doing a bit of filming for Carp TV the following week. So I've got back in the swim, and I had a bite, and I'd been played by Bream, quite a few Bream and Pit 3, and I've got this bite, and it was probably about an hour before first light, and it was a very, very Breamy sort of take, you know, not really anything, just a bit like Bream, really, just non-descriptive. You know, the bobbin was just dancing up and down. I thought, oh, for fuck's sake, you know, it's another Bream. So I've picked the rod up. Obviously, you know, I've got the hump thinking, oh, God, you know, it's wrecking my chances, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, and it's coming in really easy. I'm still thinking it's a Bream, and it's got about 60 yards out. And then obviously the rod's hooked over, and I thought, oh, shit, this isn't a Bream. So it wasn't like a spectacular fight. I'm not going to build it up to be to something it wasn't. And so it's gone in the net, put the head torch on, and I thought, oh my days, that's massive. So I've gone and waked Joe Morgan up next door. Joe being Joe just went, oh, just throw it in the sack. He says, it's too early for me. So I've gone back, and I've weighed it, and it was 42.4. It was a fish called Black Eye. And it was ever so weird that I'd only gone to Frimley, and I was obviously overjoyed that we got it on film and everything else. And I suppose it just goes to show. And I went there for a 40-pound common, and I loved it there. And do you know what? I closed the gate after that session and never went back, because I thought, I want to catch a 40-pound common. And I'm that sort of angler. I don't stay on a lake to catch everything. I don't stay there for years. Until I achieve what I think I want to achieve, or I've set myself a goal, and I shut the gate. You know, that was the achievement for there. But I don't know, I suppose the achievement that I'm really proud of is the fact that I'm able to sustain me living from the carp fishing industry, and that's obviously thanks to being in it a long time. And you know, I had a full time wage from doing my stuff with Shimano and Dynamite and tuitions, and you know, it's not just about the fish catching, it's everything that goes with it. And I'm really proud that I'm able to maintain that side, and I think that means more to me to be involved with nice people and meet nice people, and I feel really proud that I've achieved that and managed to achieve some sort of longevity in the industry. And I think you get that with treating people with the same respect that you expect from them. So above all, the fish, whether it's 40 pounders and 50 pounders, I think, you know, my greatest achievement is I like to try and be a nice person.
It's nice to be nice, isn't it, Mark? And Ian McMillan's a nice fella.
Oh, he is. We've both known him for a long time from the Armalade days, and you know, the fact that we're still friends with him is testament to he is a genuine nice fella. Something we could all learn from, I think.
Without doubt. Big ups to Mr. Ian McMillan. So, who's next up in the achievement stakes? I'm guessing, I had to guess a 3 in 5 shot, I guess it's another Ian.
We've done 2 of the 3. Let's go for another one, a hat trick. Now, this is another really, really nice person, Ian Russell.
Okay, let's see. Ian Russell's greatest achievement.
What would you consider to be your greatest carping achievement?
I bloody knew. Do you know how? I don't even know how I knew that, but I felt that was going to be your first one.
Yeah.
Greatest carping achievement, right? Are we talking bankside, or are we talking business wise, or just the carp world, or what?
Anything, mate. What you consider?
Wasn't ready for me to ask you a question, then, was he? You sob. No. Right. I would. Bloody hell, that is an art. Do you know what? I've done. Without sounding egotistical, I've done so much in this carp world, in the industry as well as the actual carp world. It's hard to pin anything down. I would say I'll choose winning the competitions. I don't have a lot of time for competitions these days, but I entered something called Battle Carp years ago, which was a DHP thing running from the magazines.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I think it was about 16 sort of hand-picked anglers from the magazine, obviously. Derek Ritchie, Ronnie Bass, you know, lots of names in there, Lee Jackson, blah, 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 blah. And I was slotted in, and the honest truth is I wasn't going to be in it. Yeah. I was slotted in because they were short of two people. And I went into it at the first round with my business partner at the time, Paul Howell.
Yeah.
And Paul wasn't really up. He's a great guy, but he wasn't much of a fisherman. So obviously I won that round. But I went through. I was a lot more aggressive in my angling in them days. And I went through and won it. But I didn't only win it once. So I won it twice. There was like a two or three year gap between these series of matches. And I managed to win the first series against John Shoes, who became my boss at Avid.
Yeah.
Won that off of him on Oxley's, and the second series, I mean, I could run you off a whole list of people that I battled against and managed to win, some of them God knows how, but I did. And the second one was a televised one, on the second final, that is, on Fort Lee against Ian McMillan. And I won that one, and do you know the emotion? This is why I stopped cut up fishing. It became a little bit, if I can use the word bitchy, if you can find a different terminology than that, so then you use it, but it became very bitchy, and I didn't like the fact, the competition bit. When I went into these, I loved it. It was so aggressive, and the emotions in a match have to be experienced by being in a match. But in that final, Ian summed up for me at the end of it, and Ian's one of my greatest friends on earth, and still is, I'm happy to say. In that match, there was a period when I'd five or seven or eight or nine bites all in a row, but and he said at the end of it, he said, I've got to be honest with you, and I'm not doing any of these again, he said, because love you as a friend, I hated you. Every time I'm about a Delkin went off, I hated you more and more and more. That's not a good thing to be in. So I re-evaluated what I was doing. I've done one more series with Crafty Carper called Carp Wars, when young Lewis was the guy there, and I won that as well. But I don't like him anymore. But that, to me, I've met a lot of great names. You know, Lee Jackson, the guy's phenomenal. So many names I fished against and managed to win. Chilcott buffed him out of the area. Everybody, you know, most of the names that were out at the time, I beat them. But more importantly, without feeling an ego, that enabled me to form friendships with them in the trade and on the bank. And I loved it. So although it was a fantastic time, if you ever invite me to say that, it's all contradictory, isn't it, Mark? Online TV have got me doing these blooming car matches, which I totally regret saying yes to this year. But I enjoyed my matches then, the BCC's, the Fieldy Silver.
Yeah.
I sort of burnt out on them. I didn't enjoy them at all, and I haven't done them for years. And I've lost that aggressive streak. I know I have, because I enjoy my fishing more now than match fishing. But I've just been talked into doing a series of, I think we've got to do, there's me, Laney, Adam Penning, Jerry Allen, Ian Chilcott, and a member of the public who's won some competition to fish with. These are 24-hour one-on-ones, and the winner's a 72-hour match in France. But I'm already regretting, they're all my friends, other than this member of the public. I don't really like fishing matches, Mark, so why the hell I even agreed to do it, I don't know, but I would say for me, with my angling at the time, where Heathrow was going at the time, my bait company, Battle Carp was a massive achievement for me inside. I've got a big trophy from it, and it's something I won, and I've got all the clips in a scrapbook, so very proud of that period of my life, although you can stick it now, I don't like the message at all.
So, are you undefeated then?
Pardon?
Are you undefeated?
Right. Well, God, this is... I got rode into doing... I lost a match, I think, if I'm correct, it was my 40th one-on-one match without losing. And this year I'm going to upset a friend of mine. Lewis Reed is a blooming good friend of mine, and we hug each other to death when I see him. I ended up somehow doing this cricket carp fishing with Carpology. It was meant to be a one-off with me and Ian McMillan on Bray's Nose 1. Somehow then I got talked into doing another one, and then another one, and I ended up in what was seems to be the final of it against Lewis on some little lake in Essex. Now, I'm going to mention this, and I've mentioned this to Lewis, and we just laughed about it, but the cut-off point was 6 p.m. I'd had a 25 and a 19. It was on numbers, not weight.
Yeah.
Lewis had a couple of low doubles, so it was amount of fish, so we're drawing now. I said to the young reporter at the time, whose name escapes me, thankfully for him, right, what happens at 6 p.m. If we're 2-on-2? And the reporter said, well, we'll go on aggregate then, so you will nick it because of the weight of the fish. And I said, fine. And we sat there jostling away anyway. At some stage in the evening, Lewis had a bite. And he reeled in this thing, which was about, I think it was 5.5 pounds. When he had the bite, I looked at my watch, and it was 6:15. And I said, well, hang on, we finished the match at 6 p.m, but because we waffled, we got over the time. And Lewis has got this little scamp in the net, and the reporter was looking at me, and they both said, well, you call it. Now, I had a massive thing on my shoulders there that I'd never lost a one-on-one, and this was I'm sure it was my 40th one, Mark, irrespective of that, really. But it was a massive thing. I had everything to lose on that decision that I was now given. So I thought it was the best at the time and said, mate, count the fish, I come second. And that was that. And I love him, Lewis. Lewis really is the absolute gonad in my world. But that is how I lost my unbeaten record, actually. So,
yeah.
So I did and I didn't, but it was put on me to make the decision, and I still think I made the right decision. I love Lewis, and it doesn't matter to him anyway. It mattered massively to me, but not enough to lose a friend.
I know Lewis Reed. I fished with him on Yateley. He was on the car park at the same time as me, and he caught Heather during my time on there. He caught Heather in February on an absolutely crazy day where, for those that don't know, Yateley Car Park Lake had 9 mirrors and 5 commons in its sort of heyday. The commons were put in later on as well, so it originally had the 9 mirrors. And your target was one fish a year. You know, you were lucky. Lots of people didn't catch a fish, but your target was one fish a year, and bites were few and far between, as you can imagine. I forget the frequency of the bites, but I mean, I don't know if it did one bite a week. Probably less on average than that. Anyway, it did 3 bites in a night in February. And one of those bites was Lewis with Heather. I forget the weight. I think it was 50 pounds. It was the fish he wanted. It was on a full moon. It was a cold night, but it had been mild. And what an amazing capture that was. And shout outs to Lewis Reed. Now he's one of the main guys at Gardner. And you've been doing all the interviews so far. I spoke to Lee Jacko Jackson, and I asked him what's his greatest achievement.
My greatest fishing achievements, I mean, there's been lots of things over the years that have really made me happy as Larry, if you like, but probably my greatest fishing achievements, if I like to pick two, which had equal sort of meant equally as much to me, was one was obviously my capture of 2-tonne. I mean, 2-tonne, when it got caught in, I mean, because I'm predominantly only, and still today, and only a short session angler, obviously my fishing involves fairly local fishing. So I can't, travel the length and the breadth of the country because I'm doing sessions, longer sessions. And I can always remember when Rod Killick caught 2-tonne over 50 pounds, and that was actually on the day of Princess, unfortunately, the day of Princess Di's funeral. that inspired me to have a go for it, because I thought, well, here we are, one of the biggest carp in the country, and I've got a chance to fish for it because it's in Kent, and I've fished I fished Collingbrook prior to this, but to be perfectly honest with you, I found it a little bit too difficult for me, if you like, because there was other people, I was fishing other waters where you were catching 30 pounders and things like that, and so it's very difficult. So I mean, when you embark on fishing places like Collingbrook, in reality you've got to recall as many carp as you possibly ever want to catch, because you might not ever see a bobbin move again, and at the end of the day, I mean, there's some terrific anglers fishing there, and at the end of the day, it's down to a bit of luck, really, because, some people caught two-tone fairly quickly. And we can all cast out the lake, but unfortunately, unless you can see the fish, you can't pick and choose what picks up your bait. I've fished it for predominantly about 5/6 years prior to catching two-tone, that was only really in the summer. I mean, I did have some mad sessions in the winter when I went down there for the sake of fishing, really. Had no chance of catching anything, and in those 5 or 6 years I fished it, I've been successful with numbers of fish I'd caught, but I'd not caught that one, and it just become more and more of, it's only, ever since I started fishing, especially carp fishing, I've always wanted to catch as many as I can catch, and hopefully one day, I'll catch the odd big one. But there's only two fish in my life that I've ever been completely obsessed with catching. One was two-tone and another one was she from the school pole. The session I caught it, I'd lost all interest, to be honest with you. I didn't actually intend to go fishing. I was having a bit of a good roll on the lake because I'd got this bread method going, which I felt that I could catch every carp in the lake and I had the confidence, providing I could get the swim I wanted. I predominantly used to fish like Wednesday straight from work, all day Thursday and Thursday night, and come back to work Friday morning. Provided I could get on, because the method was working so well, I thought that if I could get one of the swims I wanted, one of the two swims I wanted, then it wasn't a case of was I going to catch, it was what one was I going to catch.
Nice.
But by the time sort of end of August came, I was all set to go fishing in France like a couple of days later, and I had to get myself ready for that, and there was a World Championship match thing at Redouta a few days or a week or so after that, so I really didn't intend to go fishing, but I thought, I don't know, I'll just get popped down there for a night, and I can honestly say that was probably the first day in all the time I'd ever fished Collingbrook, that two-tone never entered my thoughts. I was always thinking about it throughout the day and looking at pictures of it and things like that, and I was almost sort of fishing on autopilot, really, lo and behold, sort of 5 o'clock-ish in the morning, I caught it, and it was, I can remember, I was all by myself, I wasn't the only person on the lake, coincidentally there was two other record holders, former record holders on the lake, one was Terry Levy Oscar and one was Kevin Cummings. Wow. and they were both asleep, and I can remember getting a bite. It was on a really, really foggy morning, it's dark, foggy, and to be honest with you, it was a little bit eerie, because normally, I had a line bite, which woke me up about 5 o'clock, and I just sat, kicked my legs around on the bench there and just sat there, and it was really eerie sitting there, because there was, I couldn't see an hand in front of me, and normally you'd hear the hum of the motorway nearby M20, and a little bit of noise from the factories, but there was nothing, I can really distinctly remember a shiver going down my spine, and then with that, one of me rods blitzed off, I had no idea. Prior to it going, I heard a fish jump out in the darkness, which sounded like a smallish fish, so that's what I expected it to be. When I netted it, I was struggling to sort of lift the net out of the water, and I thought, there's perhaps some weed, because the lake was ever so weedy at the time, and I got the edge taut, and and I'd see a little glimpse of it to know it was a mirror. I don't know why I thought it, but there's a fish in there called Tom's Pet. There's a mirror, low 30 pounders. And for some reason, it struck me that it was that never did I dream it was a two-ton. And when I got myself sorted out, went back and had another look. Well, I can't explain the feeling. I just sort of floated up on cloud nine, you know, and I've got to be honest, I made the fish safe, you know, put it in a sack and sort of got myself together, and I must admit to sitting down there shedding a few tears, you know, tears of joy, you know, and it was really, really, really emotional. And then obviously got in contact with people, you know, wanting to come down and, you know, photograph it for me, and the first two people there was Colin Davison and Paul Forward, and then Ian Brown turned up, Brownie, and they weighed the fish and they photographed the fish, and it was just a magical moment sharing it with friends, you know. But the entire day was memorable because I didn't stop. I mean, after everyone, you know, disappeared, I mean, my phone didn't stop ringing, or I think a lot of the country, you know, Carp World country knew of my obsession of catching that fish, and my phone just didn't stop ringing. And when I eventually turned my phone off because I had to get packed up, when I drove to work, when I got to work, all the time I was driving down the M20, my phone was continually ringing and receiving texts. And when I drove in the car park 40 minutes later, I looked at it and it was 52 messages received, you know. Wow. Then I walked in the shop and there was an email. This just shows you how the Carp grapevine works. There was an email from South Africa and a fax from Australia, you know. So it was unbelievable, wasn't it? But it just, I walked around in the days for that day, you know. And so I think, you know, it's a bit of luck what Carp picks up your bait. A lot of times you go carp fishing, but, you know, for me, that was, you know, that was my day. You know, that was the day that stick in my brain forever, you know. And Connybrook was such a special place as well. I used to really couldn't wait to go fishing for a number of reasons, like the people on the bank, the base itself, and the buzz of fishing for the biggest carp in the country, and the fact that it was a British record was just really a bit of a bonus, really. You know, and I remember one thing about it. I'll just quickly mention this. When I actually claimed the record, you get a witness form to, you know, for witnesses to fill in, and there was witness to weighing and witnesses to capture. We had no problem with the witnesses to weighing because other people weighed it. But witnesses to capture, and I thought, well, you know, the only person actually see that carp going to land in it was me. You know, and I didn't want to lie. I mean, I could have lied about it, you know, and said, well, yeah, would you sign that, Kevin or Terry or whatever? But I didn't. And so, because of that, I had to go to a commissioner of oath and swear an affidavit on the Bible.
Wow.
which was absolutely, you know, I couldn't believe it. I swear by Almighty God that the contents of this affidavit are the truth, the old truth, and nothing but the truth. And then pay £5 for the privilege of swearing, you know.
That's interesting, isn't it? How do you think that works in the future? I mean, it's nice to know there is an official, legal process for records to be claimed. And it's funny, isn't it, when you look at these little details, the legal stuff. You don't think about it, do you, unless you've been in that position. You just think, I've caught the fish. And I know what that feeling's like to catch a target fish, but as you said, to catch the biggest fish in the country, a British record, that feeling must be tenfold, twentyfold, you know.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, I can go back to times when I saw the Clarissa in London Zoo, you know, when I was a young lad, and seeing that fish swimming around, and, you know, which coincidentally was almost 50 years to the day to when I caught two-ton.
Wow.
Yeah, just a few days difference, you know, but, you know, when I used to wander around that, Yeah. You know, there's my mum and dad, and watching, you know, I was mesmerised by that fish, and never did I dream I'd catch a number of fish bigger than that, you know. You know, someone had told me that, I thought that was, you know, absolutely crazy. But no, definitely, but I think that since that, I mean, since my capture of it, which was in 2002, I think the Rod Cult Committee of British Record Committee have sorted themselves out a little bit, because at the time they used to have about 2 meetings a year, and like then one they'd have to adjourn the meeting because one of the people had to go off to the dentist or something like that, so it was another 6 months before the next lot of records were discussed. Yeah. And this, you know, this day and age of emails and things like that, it was so antiquated, you know, because Gary Bayes actually held the record before me, but he'd never been credited with the record. And so I did actually cause a little bit of a stir with the, you know, with the record committee, and I said, yeah, that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's wrong that Gary Bayes hasn't been recognised, and from what I understand, unfortunately, I'm in a position to claim another record, but from what I understand, it's a little bit more efficient than it used to be. You know, but at the time, it was a nightmare trying to claim a record, you know, and get it recognised and whatever. But other than Two-Tone, the only one, I'll keep this one short, but I do get involved in a little bit of the match side of carp fishing, you know, the big matches. I like the big international matches, and I consider this the hardest week fishing of my life physically, you know, which was in 2011 on the St. Lawrence River, in the American side of the St. Lawrence River, when me and Chile won the carp angling world championships. And to be honest with you, everything, it's such hard work. I mean, you've got to be baiting all the time, you know, otherwise you're not getting bites. You've got the rocky terrain to deal with, you know, you're clambering over rocks to get to your rods. You've got hard fighting St. Lawrence carp, and you've got these flying things and buzzy things that land on you and draw blood before they've even stung you, you know. And in 5 days and 5 nights, we had a total of 7.5 hours sleep.
Wow.
And once it got to about, you know, when you get on towards the end of the week and end of the 5 days, and we were thinking we could actually win this, you know, and it was physically, we were so knackered, our backs ached like you couldn't believe, you know, Chili's feet were all swollen up, so he's unable to put footwear on, but when it was all over and we won, you know, I can't explain it again, I can't explain that feeling, and in the evening when they had the presentation, when you walk up on that stage, we're not the greatest carp anglers in the world, but for that moment in time, it felt like we were, you know. And it's no different if you're a boxing champion or you're a, you know, motorsport champion or anything like that. When you walk up on that stage and you're holding that trophy because you've won a world championship match, it's that's a feeling that will live with you forever as well, you know.
Amazing.
So, them two in particular, but there's been another, like, you know, there's been quite a few other little, you know, highs and lows, you know.
But, well, we'll go on to the lows, because we're going to cover disaster session as well. we can certainly get some lows in. But that's a fantastic story for the first one. I kind of figured that Jacko's his greatest achievement would be catching the British record. I mean, it would, wouldn't it? Is that something that appeals to you? Record hunting.
If I could get a ticket for Wazin, where the parrot lives, I'd be on it like a tramp on chips.
At Home Fen, that's where you need to get your ticket.
Yeah, will that ever be accepted for a record, or is that a debate for the main cast?
I don't know how long it's been in there. I mean, do you know what size they stock those fish? I'm not sure if I do.
The Israeli fish, and I'm sure. Well, we have to read last week's carp talk. That had it all in there, had the feature on. I've not seen it yet, but...
yeah.
I don't know. It's a different style of fishing. It's holiday fishing. I've seen on Facebook someone's put a picture of a 50 from there and mentioned it's on a stag do.
Wow.
Whereas catching Two-Tone over however many years it took Lee to catch it, and you know what it meant to him, a totally different entity. Although I'd fish Home Fen myself, I don't think the fish from there should be a record.
No,
the
but
record
how
should mean something.
I don't know how you stop that, though. That's the problem. I mean, that's exactly what happened with the Catfish record, and they just got scrapped the record. They went, right, well, we can't verify the origins of these fish anymore, but we know loads of big fish come in the country. The lines are too blurred. Okay, there's no more Catfish record. And I can really see that happening with carp. I can, so... A greatest achievement of a British record. I mean, it's probably one that only a few are ever going to see in the future, I think.
Yeah, yeah, not many. And it's kind of a shame the way it's going, but, you know, history fish are going. But do you think there will be more history fish like a two-tone in the future?
Yeah, history's being made all the time. I'm a strong believer in things moving forward. You know, there's always significant things that happen. There'll be fish that are found in new lakes. You know, you've got to fish a lake this year that nobody knew of that's got a load of big fish in it, and I'm sure there's others like that knocking around the country. And, yeah, there'll always be history made. I heard a rumour today, actually. I'm not sure I can say it. But if I can be deceptive and cryptic, a lake where all the fish were believed to have died, including an iconic fish, may possibly have two other 50s currently residing in there. How about that? No, let's not say any more. Let's just whet the appetites of big unknown fish.
Tell me off air.
Maybe. Steve Briggs, you spoke to him, didn't you, Mark?
Oh, another absolute star of a bloke with some brilliant, brilliant stories. And his achievement story is, again, it's inspiring. Have a listen.
Well, greatest achievement. I mean, there's been a few moments down the years that I suppose, you know, would fall into sort of greatest achievements. I mean, not being funny, I can think of one straight away, but I suppose, you know, there's a couple like winning the second World Carp Cup with Tim Paisley. That was a major achievement, because to this day, you know, no one's still managed to win two. You know, there's lots of teams that have won one World Carp Cup, but no one's ever won two, and we managed to do that in America. So, you know, that's, you know, quite an achievement, and it was one that pleased me. But, you know, as far as achievements go, my greatest one's got to be catching the Black Mirror, because, you know, without a doubt, it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, physically and mentally. It was such a hard thing mentally to do, because basically it was a nature reserve and you weren't meant to be there fishing. And physically, because it was just so overgrown, the lake was a complete jungle. With just only a handful of fish in 40 acres of weed-filled water. So basically, you could be at one end, see a fish jump at the other end, and I would always move. If I saw a fish, I'd always move on it. So moving all my gear from one end to the other was, you know, a real job and a half in itself. And, you know, I did that for best part of 5 years. I started fishing it in 2005, and I went down there really totally blind. I didn't know anyone who was fishing it. I didn't get any information, which, looking back, sort of set me back quite a bit of time. But I did everything off my own back. And at the end of the day, I was pleased I did. I learned everything myself. But it was such a, you know, a big job to take on. And, well, I suppose the first couple of years, I was just pleased to see a fish. You know, I didn't go full on the first couple of years, but I sort of eased my way into it, and gradually over time I started to piece bits together. And I remember it was 63 nights to get my first fish on the bank, and it was a 20 pound common, you know, and God, I can remember it like it was yesterday. And it was just an amazing sort of feeling, because I remember seeing a fish the day before feeding on the baits, but there was a few people around, so I thought, well, I can't fish. So I went home, and all I could think about was this fish that I'd seen. So I went back that night, and I was laying in my bed, in my sleeping bag, with my waders on, my chest waders on. You know, I was so confident I was going to get a bite and have to jump in the lake. Sure enough, I did. But the big in itself, you know, once I caught that first one, things sort of, you know, sort of moved on a little bit. I had a lot more confidence and started to piece things together. And, you know, when I caught the Black Mirror, it was quite a strange thing. I literally just turned up to do probably two or three nights. And again, I checked the same baited area as I caught that first fish from, saw a common down there feeding, quickly sort of assembled a rod together and lowered it in on the spot and just stepped back. And I thought, oh, I'll send Joan a text to say I've seen the fish feeding. Step back, and literally the alarm sounded. You know, I'd been there 5 minutes. Sure enough, it was the Black Mirror. You know, so after all the 5 years or whatever, you know, it all seemed so simple in the end, but it was the culmination of like 5 years of hard work, you know. And like I say, it was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. It still is. So I don't think I could ever catch a fish that's going to beat that one or achieve something that's going to beat that. So yeah, I think that was my greatest achievement.
How many people are going to have the Black Mirror as their greatest achievement? It shows what a calibre of angler we've got on the show, doesn't it? Because quite a large amount of them have caught that fish, and what a fantastic carp it is. And I think the trials and tribulations associated with catching it, you know, you're at one with nature, you're not really supposed to be there, there's a few other people sneaking about, it's just a bit of me, how I wish I'd have fished for that fish.
Yeah, are you at one with nature or are you against nature?
I'm at one. I'm like, have you seen that film Avatar? It's connected to the trees. That's like me.
You're a hippie.
No, but I do think we can learn a lot from nature. I'm not a tree hugger by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think plants are living, breathing things. I do think, I don't want to go too crazy, but I think they have some sort of soul, as it were. Maybe emotions. Well, I don't know.
Do you think they know when they're about to get eaten or gone over with a lawnmower?
I'm sat with the salad right next to me now, so I apologise, Bill Burt. What they ever called? There's a bit of beetroot. He can get it. I don't like beetroot. He doesn't deserve to be on this planet. It's nasty. But yeah, talking of trees and stuff, I mean, there's two significant times of year, both associated with decent fishing. One's the spring where everything buds, and the other one's the autumn where the harvest comes and everything fruits, and we're approaching the autumn, aren't we, Mark? Which has always been my favourite time of year. I prefer it to the spring. I know most people's favourite month is May, but ever since I was a kid, I think what it is, it's when we were a kid, you weren't allowed to fish in the spring because there was a close season from March 15th. So the highlight of the year was always September, October. And I always used to do better in October than September, although September's generally more productive. I mean, the season seems to have moved on a little bit, don't we? We've had so many mild Decembers and Januaries recently, haven't we? That who knows what this autumn's got in on offer, but have you made plans?
Well, the wife has 2 weeks on bloody holiday, ruining my fishing.
In the 14 years I've known you, you've always gone away at prime time in the autumn. Never really done an autumn campaign.
It's her birthday and it's her 40th this year, so I can't really argue too loud. But yeah, in between that misses maybe 2, possibly 3 weeks off there. So I'm still going to be, you know, on it through the rest of September, half of October, November, into December. And, you know, my syndicate, can I name it on this? This is the extra.
You can do. It's up to you. You can name on the new one if you wanted. It's up to you.
Well, I'm not. So, yeah, it has got depths down to 20 foot, a lot of it. So it will produce and does produce. So I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep plugging away. The fish, they spawned late, so I think they'll be having a good feed up. It's just started to switch on this week. I caught two over quite a lot of bait, which is my favourite autumn tactic. And you mentioned autumn and spring. I'm the same. I do prefer autumn to spring because there's not as many zigs involved. Yeah. I much prefer
There's not as many SIGs. There's less anglers generally. The bank's quieting down sort of September, October quite significantly after the summer. And the fish are on the munch. I mean, the stereotype is that they have an autumn feed up in preparation for winter. Now, I'm not sure that's the case anymore, but I do think we get really good carpy conditions in the autumn. You know, we get big winds. You know, those overcast rain, and you know, while there's still some temperature in the water, the fish generally head to the deeper parts. I don't know if you ever noticed, but certainly on all the gravel pits I've fished, the deepest end is where an easterly wind blows, and we get a few easterlies in the autumn as well. And it's more than coincidence, because I could probably name five or six gravel pits I've fished off the top of my head where the deep ends where the easterly blows. So, like the west end of the lake. I don't know if that's just how they dig gravel pits, you know, facing a certain direction for the excavation or for the prevailing winds, or I don't know why, but it certainly is a fact that the majority I've fished, the deep end is where an easterly wind blows. And we get easterlies in the autumn. The water's holding temperature longer. If you listen to the Rob Hughes Underwater Thermocline interview we did with him, you know, that those layers will get intermeshed, and I don't know. I just think the deeper water, as soon as it starts going cold, the water temperature starts noticeably dropping. You can tell that with, like, I always gauge it off my cold water tap in the house. Like, you know, like the temperature of your cold water that comes out, you can, I can gauge it from coming out of the winter into the spring. You know, you can taste a noticeable difference in the water that you drink, because obviously the water, the pipes are underground, and it's, I think the thing that makes the biggest difference to the water temperature in the lake is the ground temperature. Obviously that's what the water's sat on, which is affected by the atmospherics. I don't know. I mean, I've took a lot of temperatures over the years. I think it's more significant in the winter, but as soon as that water starts dropping from the summer, that's when I think we need to pay attention to our bait at that time of year as well. I've had baits that have stopped working once those temperatures have started dropping. I've caught well on them all summer, and then all of a sudden, because fish are warm-blooded. Are they warm-blooded? Cold-blooded. We're warm-blooded. Mammals are warm-blooded. Fish are cold-blooded, which means their body temperature changes with the water, whereas ours is always consistent, isn't it, regardless of the temperature outside. And I think their digestion changes, and there's certain things they don't digest as well once that water temperature starts dropping. And as soon as that does significantly drop, their feeding habits have changed instantly. So
yeah, definitely. I've been speaking to the chaps who I get my bait from about the krill and shrimp bait I'm on at the minute, whether that's worth carrying on. And it will catch all the way through the year, but they'd have one, just if you're going to use it through the winter, just use very, very minimalist tactics with it. So I'm going to kind of start introducing another creamy bait that they do at the same time, with a view of, because I like to fish up a lot of bait. So the creamy one does go, it goes through them like a Porsche.
Yeah, it's a good time of year to pre-bait as well, isn't it? It's a good time of year to start getting some bait in a chosen autumn area, and you're fishing for that hit. I always feel like I'm fishing for a mega hit in the autumn, do you?
I want it. There is the lake I'm on, it is capable of sun. Some of my mate Martin, he had one in the spring. I think he had 220s, 230s and 240s.
Wow.
So just half of that I'd be quite happy with. Well, I'm... got them on the bait. I know they like it already. They were on me this week for maybe 2-3 hours at most, and I caught two. I have no doubts they'll be on the bait. And is it something I've when was the last time you wrapped a hook bait in paste?
Well, every time I cast out now, because that's how the cultured hook baits come, and I've been using them for about a year now. So yeah, but I know what you're saying. I saw a picture of you the other day casting out a pasty type hook bait.
Yeah, it was 12mm Snowman, 12mm pop-up, 12mm bottom bait, in the middle of a great big blob of the stuff. And it's just something that I used to do years back, and I've not done for a long, long time, and I just don't know why. It's so effective, and it's worked for me. And with a mega-sharp hook, a right place, I'm fishing up a lot of... Well, I can get away with, there's no bream in the lake, and which is brilliant.
And I've been putting a lot of small particles of food in there. You know, a lot of chopped boilies, the mandatory tin of corn, just because you can. A lot of hemp. Hemp seed is a brilliant autumn bait, and do not be shy with it. You know, you can fill it to the it's an inch deep on the bottom. And don't be worried about the old myth of preoccupation either. You know, all you need to do is, like in the picture you just mentioned, get a short hook link. You know, they just don't move as much when they're feeding. They're on boilies, they move from one to the other. When they're on the small particles, they're just kind of like hoovering the bottom. Your hook link can be as short as, 3 inch.
I completely agree. The hemp is a fantastic bait. Let's carry on, get and lighten this up. Let's get some funny stories in.
Oh, this is fun recording all these. Who should we go for first?
Adam Penning. Let's go back to Adam and let's hear his funniest.
Oh, this is a good one.
Funniest stories on the bank.
So we're out in France fishing a match. I'm paired with Chilcott, and it's right in the, I can't remember what region, the Alsace region or something, but it was in the middle of flipping nowhere, and it was on a river. It was England v France pairs match, and we were pegged up on the far side of the river, which was backed onto, well, it was on the slope of a mountain, basically. So behind us, we had massive wooden, wood-lined escarpment running up behind us. It was so wild. There was no swims. It never probably been fished, and we had to literally cut swims into the rock face and cut bushes out so we could get brollies up. It was totally wild. And someone was going to come back with water every couple of days to keep us alive and a few supplies. But other than that, we were left on our own. And, it was nice. It was totally wild. You know, it was amazing, actually. We had an incredible view, and it was quite nice being cut off from civilization. And so behind us was just this forest, and well, you go in there, you know, if you had to go to the loo, you know, because we were totally left to the wild, dig a hole, burn a paper, that sort of thing. And anyway, we hear things at night in these woods behind us, like unearthly noises and branches snapping. And I was getting a bit jittery, but I was thinking, and Chilly was like, oh, it's just big deer or maybe some hogs or something. And okay, so anyway, the next day we've heard the French out, it might have been a Sunday or something, we heard the French hunting party, because we heard all the dogs with bells on their necks and all these dogs and a few people got a couple of guns going off and these French voices shouting, and one of them sounded quite alarmed, and we heard one of the dogs whimpering, and I'm thinking, oh, flipping, what's going on here? And Chilly's going, oh, they're just hunting warthogs or something. Oh, okay, all right, well. Anyway, when the next French guy came over in the boat from the other side to give us some supplies and some water and that, we got chatting to him. He said, what are the guys hunting up there? And, you know, what's in these woods? We've heard these noises. He said, oh, it's one of the very few regions in France which has still got bears. So we're like, really? He said, yeah. He said, they're black bears. He said, they're quite big, but they won't come near you. You know, they're more afraid of you than you are. You know, all that old waffle. So, oh, right, okay. So now it's, you know, going out of the bivvy and going into the woods to have a poo is like taking on a whole new meaning, because when you're out there in the woods, you also know that the bear's shit in the woods as well. So you're looking around quite nervously while you're on your haunches, and you hear these noises, and that we never saw anything until the last day. And Chilcott was in his camp, in his bivvy, just next to me. I've gone out in the boat, and I'm trying to find a spot with the sonar. It's a really deep bit of river. I'm dropping the odd marker and trying to get a rig placed. And so I'm out there doing that, and I don't know what came over me, but I'm about 100 yards off the shore. Looking back, I can see Chilly potting around, and he's just surrounded by this huge forest and this massive mountain going up behind him. It was quite an incredible view. And I don't know what came over me. I just thought, I'm just going to have him. And I stood up in the boat. I turned the motor off and I went, Chill, don't look back. Just get in the water, mate. Just get in the water. Just flipping, get in the water. Run. Just get in the water. And he did. He dropped his cup of tea everywhere and just ran headlong into the river. I must have put on quite a good show of it, because he didn't question it for a second. And he ran into the river up to his waist and then continued to run along the margin, like he had a jet propulsion system underneath the surface of the water. And he's going, well, don't stay out there, then come, just come in and get me, just come, for the love of God, Penning, come in and get me. I'm going, all right, I'll turn the boat in. He's rampaging up the margin, up there to get on. I was going, there's two of them, Jill, there's two, just keep going, mate, I'm coming in. He's going, come in faster. I said, I'm on four clicks. It won't go any faster. He says, hurry up for the love of God. So I've gone in and I've eventually got the motor in. And he's jumped in the boat. And as he's landed in the boat, he's kicked the edge of the bank to push us off really quickly to get us as far away from the land as possible. So he's gone like that and he's gone, whoa, flipping out. And we've gone drifting out into the thing. He said, turn that motor on quick. And well, at that moment, I couldn't carry on anymore, and I just collapsed. Well, I was already in tears, actually. Literally, I was already in tears, and I just collapsed in the boat in guffaws of laughter that I had him over so incredibly perfectly. I didn't think I would get him that well, to be honest. And he when he realised that what I had done, he really, really had the hump with me. He turned the boat around, went into shore. He climbed out of the boat. He was soaking wet. He climbed out of the boat and went back to his bivvy. He didn't speak to me until the next day. There was one other one, actually, that was quite funny. If you've got time for one more. There was just one other one that I completely forgot until I was telling you that story. But I was on St. John's once with Jim Foster, and we're shooting an article for Total Carp magazine. It's a long, long time ago. It's probably Catchmore Carp magazine then, actually, before the title changed. And so we're on the bank, and it was really hard going. It's bank holiday weekend. Couldn't get a bite. And I remembered I had some Brazil nuts in my bag. Now, Brazil nuts are my greatest get-out-of-jail card. So I said to Jim, I said, all right, struggling to get a bite, I'm going to put a Brazil nut on. And as I pulled this little brown paper bag of Brazils out of my rucksack, Jim's recoiled like I pulled a snake out. He's like, get those away from me, get those away from me. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I'll collapse in anaphylactic shock if I even touch it. I've got the worst nut allergy. He said, it literally will kill me. I said, what are you talking about? So he told me, blah, 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 he'd nearly died, and any type of nut will kill him. So I said, flipping out, that's unbelievable. I said, but how do you know you've got it? So he told me about this incident that's happened to him. I said, I've never eaten nuts. I said, I've never eaten anything with nuts in. I said, it's just not something that comes in my diet. I said, I always carry Brazil nuts around with me, like for fishing. He said, what do you mean you've never eaten nuts? He said, you might have it. He said, you might have the nut disorder syndrome or whatever it's called. And I went, don't be ridiculous, Jim. Can't be, no way. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to eat one of these Brazil nuts. And he's like, no, if you've never eaten nuts, you can't. And he's getting quite upset with me. I'm like, Jim, chill out. I'm going to eat one. So I've got this Brazil nut, bit it in half and chewed it in front of him. And the colour's just draining out of his face. He's so terrified of nuts because it's literally a life and death situation. And anyway, I've swallowed this nut down. And he's like, well, that's the most stupid thing you've ever done, Penning. And he's seen me do a few stupid things. And I said, well, there you go. Look, nothing wrong with that. So we sat down on the grass. And I said, I'm a tired rib with these Brazils. And then I threw myself backwards into a convulsive fit and made out I was having a seizure. It was probably the best bit of acting I've ever done in my life. I just threw myself over, made myself foam at the mouth. I was throwing saliva and spittle everywhere, holding my throat and rolling around in the grass like as if I couldn't breathe. And Jim's gone crazy. He's come up to me. He's like, Ad, and then he's backed right off as if it was going to like get him. And he's like, oh, what should I do? He's, mate, don't worry. He says, I'm getting an ambulance. He's gone round to his bivvy, got his phone. And he's going, oh, what's the nut? Oh, he's eventually dialed an ambulance. I'm rolling around at his feet, just like my throat is raw where I was been faking this cough and this spit and this snot coming out of my nose. And I'm gasping. I probably made myself go blue by this time. It was a masterclass of Oscar acting. And I've rolled it. And anyway, he's just got connected to the ambulance service. And I sat up and just grinned at him. And he looked at me. He looked at his phone. He pressed the red button and hung up the call. He looked back at me. He turned around. This is the editor of Total Car Magazine. He turned around, walked all the way back to his bivvy, zipped the door down in the middle of a bright hot spring day, and didn't come out until the next day. He was that pissed off at me. He wouldn't speak to me. He wouldn't look at me. And the next day, well, he was not happy. He still tells the story now. He probably tells it better than I do. But he said that it was the best that he had ever been tucked up. So, yeah, that's the Brazil nut story.
Well, a couple of great stories there from Monsieur Penning, and fantastic ones with Chile, and I'm not sure Jim Foster has seen the funny side of that one.
No, I'm quite nervous if I ever get to fish with Adam Penning. I'm going to be on the lookout for pranks.
Yeah, there's a reason why he's an extremely popular guy. Let's get Chile on and let's see what Chile's funny story is.
Funniest bankside experience, God. I mean, there has been an awful lot of them, really. You know, oh, dear. My funniest one. Oh, I'm trying to think now. Come on, Chilcox. Get your head into gear. Do you know what? I'm not boring, but yes, I'm not boring, but I always go fishing on my own. And I rarely have contact with people. I don't go fishing with mates anymore. I do it all on my own. But I remember probably the things that I laughed at the most. You know, when you're on your own, you rarely belly laugh, do you? You know, you'll find it funny and whatever, but you're rarely lying around on the floor holding your belly with tears running down your face. And I was fishing the most stunning little lake up in middle England near Northampton. And it was a misty morning. And it was great. The wildlife was just not overly excited, but the world was starting to wake up. And up by, there was a little inlet stream that came under that came in under this old bridge on this beautiful old estate. There's a little boat there. I was out of sight of the boat. I'm much further down the lake by about 400 or 500 yards. And I'm just sat there underneath my little evolution, sort of wondering why I had a bite. And just out the corner of my right eye, something started to appear out of the early morning fog, and it was two sheep sat in that boat drifting down the lake, and to this day it was one of the funniest things I'd ever saw. They didn't make a noise, they weren't bleating, they weren't doing anything. They were just stood in the boat drifting down the lake, and to this day I still cannot fathom out how they got in it, but I sat there and I belly laughed, and there were tears rolling down my cheeks, and in the end I had to trot down to the end where the actual dam wall was and hold onto the boat while they scurried out, and it was a bit of a disaster in itself. But yeah, they got out and they were safe. But yeah, that was probably the funniest thing I'd ever seen on the bank.
So we've got our own sheep stories, haven't we, Mark? You know, sheep have been following us around recently, but yeah, sheep in a boat, we haven't done that yet, have we?
No, that was carp or sheep, and the way Chile describes it, we belly laughs. I think if I was fishing in the middle of the nowhere, the mist rising, and a boat just drifts past with two sheep in there, I think I'd have probably wet myself with laughter once you actually focused and just thought, what actually is that?
Yes, completely agree. Yeah, let's move on. Let's go and find out what makes Ian McMillan laugh.
Funniest bankside experience. Oh, God. There's one that involves Ian Russell that it's kind of getting one up, but I'll come to that one in a minute. There's one that I do remember that we used to go to a complex of lakes in France called Maison de la Blerne, and it was quite prolific, lots of big fish, very, very pleasant to fish, and very manicured. And there's a load of, you'd be a coach trip, we used to have an absolute pisser. So we used to hire the complex. So we were all mates, blah, blah, blah. Well, Dave has a real problem about people snoring. The fact that he would literally kill someone if they keep him awake snoring. Now, Pete snores like a pig.
they were sort of back-to-back fishing on different lakes. So I was next to Dave. Dave's beside himself. So what Dave's basically done is he's come up with this plot. And it's a famous story, and lots of people do it. But there's quite a lot of rats about. So the first night, Dave, to get his revenge for keeping Peter, he thinks, right, well, if I don't let him sleep, then he can't snore. So what he's done is he's emptied the contents of his pallet bucket all around his bivvy when he's not there. Not like massive piles, just little bits. You know the bits that they'll just keep coming back? And the pallets that you can't see because he hasn't put masses of them. So this is one night. So Pete's all bleary-eyed at the moment. He's come across to Dave and me. And I'm having a brew and Dave's swimming. He's like, not many rats around you. I said, well, you're a couple, don't you? You're out of nature. You've got to embrace it. He went, man, they were everywhere. He said, they were running over me bivvy. They were in me bivvy. He said, I had no sleep whatsoever. I've walked off because I can't contain my laughter. So Dave isn't content with this. He says, I'm going to get him again tonight because he said Dave didn't get much sleep either because he was trying to stay awake listening for Pete's reaction about these rats that were over his So Dave said, I'm going to get him again tonight. So what he's done is Pete used to like a bit of a drink. So you'd have your meal. Pete would stay up there a bit longer. So Dave said, right, we're going to change your spools over. But we're not just going to change his spools over. We're going to keep him arsing around with his lines in the night until the point where he's uncontrollable and we give him an absolute pisser on one of his rods. So what Dave's done is Dave's laid this carefully bit of line. And I say bit of line, they're probably 20 yards apart. So he hasn't just gone direct to the swim in case Pete trips over the line and susses him. So he's tied the hook, he's gone through the trees, he's gone obviously into Paris, back down, and he's made this trap that there's no way Pete would have sprung it. Wait for Pete to put his rods out. Then I've called Pete over to do something in my, to just get him out of his swim enough times for Dave to go into the swim, swap his spools over, put his bobbins back on, and put this hook around his middle rod or onto the line. So everything's set, Dave's happy. Pete's none the wiser. We haven't put no pallet down, so he's happy that there's not as many rats out tonight. So darkness has come, we've settled down, and I'm in Dave's bivvy. Dave's got this piece of line. So I said, right, let's start to have a bit of fun. Pete was one of these that even though he's got a receiver literally 6 foot from his rods, he still has to have his alarms on full blast. He's one of those annoying people that doesn't realise that when you've got a receiver, you can have them on silent. So we started. So Dave's tweaked the line. Nothing's happened. I'm like, Dave, what have you done? The hook's come off the rod. As in, the hook's come off Pete's line. No, I said, we pulled a bit harder. Nothing's happened. So I've said, right, give me the effing line. I'm getting a bit wound up because I'm thinking, it's come off, or Pete's sussed it. So I've pulled it. And then obviously I've pulled quite, Dave's been pulling the slack. It's now, I've pulled it, and you hear his alarm just basically not going to meltdown, but giving him enough of an indication that you've heard the rustling, so he's coming out of his bag, and he's going to hit this rod. So it isn't taking line, but obviously his bobbin is up tight now because we've taken the tension out of his drop. So we've heard his alarm, we've heard him come shuffling out his bivvy. Because we've done it on the middle one, but we swapped all the spools around, we knew if he hit that middle rod, the whole lot would go up. And I mean the whole lot. So we've heard him put the rod up, and then the alarm's gone off again as he's obviously put the rod up, and then there's absolute chaos. We've heard the crash, and he's like that, oh, for fuck's sake, what's got you, bastards? Like, and obviously we couldn't, we were rolling with laughter, and he's like that, Dave, Tong. And obviously he was, the thing is, he wasn't, there comes a point where a prank gets taken too far, and I think we didn't realise that he wouldn't take it in the jest that it was meant. Well, obviously, when we've gone over to the swim, pissing us out, to find there's line everywhere, all three rods are in different positions all over the swim, he's still holding the rod that actually hasn't got a fish on, the one that we've pulled the line off. And he said, well, how did you manage to? And then he was all right about it, but he wasn't. We didn't see much of him the following day, let's put it that way. I think he wasn't best pleased. And the fact, I don't think he'd dare leave his swim in case we started messing with his kit again. But I'll tell you what, Dave had no more problems with him snoring for the rest of the week. Bless him.
Another one with pranks on the bank. Have you got any pranks that have been pulled on you or by you, Mark?
I might have done one or two in the past. I do remember on the Woolpack, the swans were a nightmare. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I do remember to get rid of them out of my end of the lake on dusk, putting a load of mixers in so they follow them down the other end of the lake where I think you might have been fishing down there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's...
sorry about that.
That's, maybe we should get a feature on the regular Carpcast pranks.
Pranks aren't cheap.
Yeah, no, I like the old Bankside pranks. I've spoke about this before, but when I used to go fishing with Dave, my pal, like it was a running joke every time we went of like who took the rubbish home. You know, obviously you fill up a couple of carrier bags full of rubbish, and it'd be a case of dumping them. You know, every time his back was turned when he was loading his motor up, you know, I'd stick it in the passenger seat, or you know, just put it somewhere he wouldn't see it straight away, and he'd get halfway home. I'd get a phone call going, "It stinks," because I've stashed it somewhere that he hasn't noticed. Or if you get off early, you know, you can just leave it.
You did that to me plenty of times.
Yeah, yeah, it's always a good one, because nobody wants to take the rubbish home. I always think your rubbish is a good place. Like, nobody wants to take the rubbish home at the end of it. Obviously, we have to. But, you know, if you can dump it on somebody else to take home, then all the better, because it's, you know, you've got 3-4 days worth of crap, and sometimes literally crap in the age of bagging up, you know, for the calls of nature. So yeah, dumping the bags is kind of a key running joke. So I don't know. I mean, I always think that's the best place to stash anything valuable, because nobody, you know, it's the last place you ever want to go in somebody else's bag of rubbish. So, you know, if you need to nip off from your swim and you want to stash your wallet or something fairly valuable, and the bottom of your bag of rubbish is probably a good place, probably the safest place on the lake, I reckon. But yeah,
I can tell you fished in Manchester thinking like this.
Yeah, well, anywhere that's a little bit shady. While I was in Amsterdam, we had the barbecue with the Urban Bank slot a few months ago. They were telling us about this lake in Paris by the Eiffel Tower they were fishing, and they got robbed every single night in a row. They got robbed to the point of, you know, they literally just got one bag, and the bag's tied to the bed chair, which is right under the head where they're sleeping, and still you're waking up in the night with somebody unzipping the zip of the bag to get the stuff out. The lads had the gear robbed every single night they're on there.
Didn't they think of leaving?
Well, they're there, you know, there's decent fishing there, number one. Number two, they're there shooting a video, aren't they? So, but yeah, it was the worst example of a theft I've ever heard about on the lake. Like, even when you know they're doing it, and you know you're gonna, it's all the homeless and the beggars and stuff that are doing it. They've got no fear, nothing to lose. I don't think they felt in danger, but it was you know, you were losing most of your gear every night. Well, wallets and that sort of stuff they're after. But yeah, if you fished anywhere shady, I'm sure you come up with these ideas. But yeah, in the bottom of your rubbish bag's probably a pretty safe place.
Yeah. Just mentioning rubbish bags before we move on, I've got to tell you this story. I was on Swarkstone. Yeah, I was fishing down off the track. I used to get to the sailing club. Yeah, it was all tarmac, and for some reason I had my rubbish bag. It was attached to, I just hooked it over the tow bar, and it was there for the evening. And a friend had come down to visit, so he phoned me up. I had to go and let him in at the gate. I drove up there, only about 100 yards. I drove up, let him in. As I turned the car round, I noticed a long trail of rubbish leading from where I was right back to the swim.
Oh dear. Yes, not good.
No.
Not anyway, good.
We've gone off track. We're going to get back to the funny tales.
Yes, don't leave litter, kids. Just remember that. And let's move on to Ian Russell. Let's see what makes him laugh.
How many do you want? Oh, bloody hell. Well, the one with the boat was funny, but it wasn't. I don't know. I mean, I've lent in to put me buzz bar and fell in. That was quite comical. That was when we were on the way. We went fishing after the pub one night. But an unfunny one was blowing off, and it wasn't a blow off. Most of us have done that one night. You've had to go home. Hooks in fingers. I had one the other week. It involved me as a doctor. I was fishing with the Apache, Steve Cliff, bit of a tough geezer, diesel fitter, you know what I mean, geezer. And he's putting this boiling needle through a boilie while talking to me, and he's gone straight through, sucking his finger. Dan Wildball was there doing a feature with him, right? So this isn't directly what happened to me, but I thought it was great. Steve has turned into the biggest wuss on the planet. Now, I said to him, mate, cut the needle off, I'll yank it out, you're still fishing. No, no, Dan Wildball was giving it all. I've got to tell you, I've got, Dan's a big lad and a lovely lad. I've got to tell you, I can't handle even looking at that. Well, I can handle it, and I want to rip it out. So anyway, no, can't do that. He's cut it off, it was a little called a yellow one. Very sharp, but very good needles. He's cut it off at the end of the plastic and said, right, I'm going to try and get it out if I can't go to hospital. With that, his rod's gone off. So he's playing this fish, and as he's really near, it's going, because it's in the end of his finger, it's going click, click, click against the rim. And with every click, he's going, right? That's, I'm crying, mate. Got this fish in. I've raised nose, got this fish in the net. He's laying in the net, and I said, look, mate, unhook it and go to the hospital, or leave it there. Let's have this out now, and you do your pictures. Get it out. Get it out. So I've got this blooming thing. It's actually slightly to the side of his finger, halfway in, so it's in a proper amount. And I said to him, right, if I get a pair of pliers, lean down on it, push it out the top of your finger, and then just pull it through, because you've cut the yellow thing off. Right, go for it. Well, as I've got him on it, and I really don't mind these type of things, but the Apache, for being a big, brave diesel fitter, hates them, obviously, squeamish. I've started pushing this thing with him pulling away from me. So it's not going anywhere at all. I've gone for about 2 foot chasing around the swimming, and I said, mate, Steve, well, why ain't it done yet? You told me you'd get it done. I said, well, if you stand still, I might actually be able to bloody push on it. And with that, I give it one sharp jab when he wasn't ready, and he popped out the other side. Popped out the other side. This hasn't ended yet, right? So then he squirted some stuff on it, Dan's done his work, and he's gone away. I'm in the next swim, so I can hear the conversations. Everyone that walked past, yeah, I had a ball of lily in my hand, mate. There's no way I was going to hospital, yanked it out. I'm catching fish, I ain't leaving the lake. And I'm sitting there thinking, you lying sod. You were damn near getting an helicopter to pick you up and take you into hospital. No, not me, mate. Yeah, I just yanked it through, pushed it out, had another bite. And I, actually, as if he was Arnold bloody Schwarzenegger, mate. So that, for me, was a pretty cool one on the bank, man. A funny story. But we've had loads, mate. I've set a fight to be busy. I've fell off the back of the bed chair when I've been trying to get out of the wrong side when I've had a bite. Couldn't get out of my sleeping bag. Well, we've all had these, haven't we? But because I fish a lot, I tend to get more than others, actually. Gone out without my feet on, without my shoes on, split my foot open one night, I've had a glass. La, 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 la. Oops in my own fingers. Ironically enough, I got one in my finger the other year when I was with the Apache. I had a 30-pounder on the mat, and the weight's irrelevant, but it's a big fish. I went on and it flapped. It transferred the hook to my finger while the hook link was still going through his lip. So the fish is now connected. I've got a size 4 long chain buried right into the end of my finger. Debbie's with me, my missus. Now, she can't see what's going on. And I'm saying to Steve, hold the fish, hold the fish. Every time it flaps, it's you're in fear of losing half your finger, aren't you? So I've got this fish on the ground. I said, Debs, do us a favour, pair of pliers for the bibby, please, sweetheart. She's holding the rod. So she's walked off with the rod, which is attached to the hook link, which is going through the lip, which is what someone's put. So the fish is now going mad again because Debbie got the bloody rod. There's me screaming at Debbie, saying, da, 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 da. In her defence, she didn't know what was. We didn't have scissors, they're all in the bibby, Mark, obviously. So she's come back, we've cut the hook link, I've grabbed these pliers, I've grabbed the hook, pushed it through and pulled it out. Cut the eye off the hook, pushed it through and pulled it out. The Apache is nearly dying now. White. He looked like seeing a ghost, mate. I said, what's that with you? He started, I can't be doing it. He couldn't go away from the scene because he's holding his fish to the mat. But there's no way. If you don't get the hook out immediately, you're in hospital, wouldn't you? Because it's going to swell up. So that was another story involving the Apache and his bravery. But because I've done that, and Debbie went, oh, you're my hero, aren't you? But yeah, because I bloody am. Foolish man trying to hook a fish and not looking at what he's doing. So we talk all night about accidents, mate, but the one with the Apache, it was his accident, not mine, sticks in my mind as being brilliant, because he looks so... You wouldn't want to argue with a man, because he looks so rock hard, but he's a big wussy. Lovely man. But honest, mate, everyone I walked past, yeah, I had a boy needing my finger, didn't I, mate? I yanked it out. And I didn't diss him, I just listened thinking, you bloody liar. You liar. You cried like a baby, but he did catch some more fish than Pete anyway. So there you go. There's my one, mate, or one of many.
So it's Lee Jackson up next for a funny story, and I know from reading about his exploits chasing the British record fish that there were good times had down Conningbrook. Do you ever read all about the sort of social scene down there?
I've not read his book. What was it called? For the Record.
I read it in a series of articles he was doing at the time while he was catching. I was in the days that I used to buy magazines religiously every month. And he documented his quest for two-tone during that, you know, as it happened sort of thing. Each month was, you know, what had happened the previous month. And the thing that stuck in my head were the socials, you know, sort of pictures of him with the guitars and having the sing song, the barbecues, and it looked good. Why don't we just let Lee tell us the score?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we didn't work, but that was one of the reasons I used to enjoy fishing Conybrook so much. You know, we had such a laugh down there. It was, you know, it was, we fished hard, we played hard, but, you know, the laughs we used to have was unbelievable. You know, it's, you know, for one reason or other, you know, and because I think it brought about a certain type of camaraderie, because the lake was difficult. You know, everyone respected it. It was difficult, so we had great big socials. I mean, I'd like to make it clear at this time, no time was any fish put in danger, you know, because these socials all normally went on when it wasn't bite time. But no, we've been, there's a group of lads used to fish down there who I named the Bee Gees. I think it's three or four of them that was always used to fish together, and we used to sing like BG songs across the lake to them and all that, you know, and things like that. It's just, you know, just the magic moments. And then, you know, then at some point in the evening, once our alcohol had run out, we'd go around and nick theirs, you know. And then there's also a dog on the lake that used to cause quite a few abusement. Bruce, he was the cross between a Rottweiler and a Labrador, so he's quite a big dog, you know. But he used to be like one of the lads. He used to, you know, when you're having a bit of a social, he used to sit there, you know, snobbing all around the place. And he caused some abusement at times, because he was, you know, he'd be looking across at someone's bivvy from the other side of the lake, and they'd gone to have a chat to their mate in the next swim, or had a walk off somewhere, and immediately walks off, Bruce would be in their bivvy and coming out with their food, like, you know. And I'll see that dog eat contact lenses, I'll see him eat a mobile phone, and all manner of other things, you know. And then like, there was occasions where when we used to feed him, feed him with some boilies. I can always remember my mate, I mean, whose dog it was, with Joe, a Maltese bloke, who had an house right on the lake, virtually. And I can remember my mate Rod Killick feeding Bruce with about 2 kilo of Rod Hutchinson seafood blend boilies one evening. And he ate the lot. And the next morning, we heard this Maltese voice coming from the house, and, "You dirty bastard, you dirty bastard," and she's everywhere. And there was a big house, and the dog had, and he came running out of the house with a towel around his head, you know, because of the smell, and the dog had shit in every room, you know, and things like that. And then Bruce's mate was a little Jack Russell, a little fat, and really, really fat, because we used to feed that as well. And in the end, he used to walk around the lake, and a sign hanging around his neck, "Don't feed me." You know, because... Yeah, but no, that place was, that's got loads of laughs down that place, you know. And, I say, for them reasons, you know, sometimes I used to get back to me bivvy and my ribs ached with laughter, you know, my belly ached with laughter, and I used to lay back on my sleeping bag and think, "Do you know what? When I get two-tone, I'm really going to miss this." And I did, you know. And, Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, funny story. When you said, well, you said a documentary. Yeah, Martin Ford had asked me to do a diary piece for Advanced Carp Fishing, and early on that year, he said to me on the phone. He said, November the 3rd, you'll catch it. And I thought, oh, yeah. So I had it in my head. I never dreamed I'd catch it on November the 3rd. You know, hardly anyone catches a carp in November in Connybrook anyway. And I remember saying to him, I ain't got to wait that long. And anyway, I caught it on August the 29th. I still had it in my head to go back for one last session on November the 3rd, because I can remember looking in the diary after the conversation with Martin, and November the 3rd was a Sunday night when I used to go, well, it was a Sunday, which I used to go fishing every Sunday night, and it was also a new moon, which I liked for big fish, and I thought, well, I'm going to go down there anyway, and I went down there with Silent Beta, and I must admit, we set up on Joe's Point, doubled up on Joe's Point, and I cast three baits any old way, got a donk on each rod, and that was it. We had a bit of a, you know, bit of a chinwag, bit of a social between us, and then I'd buy it around about 20 to 12 at night, and I'm convinced that was two-tone again. Absolutely convinced it was that two-tone, just by the way it was fighting and everything, and it got to about 30 yard out, and it weeded me up, and I had a boat next to me, so I could have easily got in the boat and sort of got out and perhaps landed it, but I don't know, I thought I'd just pull, you know, see if I can get it in without it, and the hook being broke or the hook pulled out. I can't remember what actually happened there, but, you know, and it would have spoiled it for me, to be honest with you. You know, the highlight was catching it back. But it's strange. Like, oh, no, he said early on in the year, he said, November the 3rd, you're going to catch it. And I'm convinced it was that fish on the end. You know, but I wasn't in the slightest bit, you know, sorry, I'd lost it, you know, because it was it weren't meant to be, you know.
Premonitions that Jacko was talking about, the date November the 3rd there. I remember a series of times where Arthur came out of the Yateley Car Park Lake. It would come out between November the 7th and November the 11th. And there's a guy on there, Fudgie, who used to fish there. I think he was one of the captors, but he used to predict it. And I think there were three separate occasions, 3 years in a row, where it came from the same swim. Well, there was two swims that fished the same area of the lake. They were like in a corner facing the same spot. The chair and the one up from the bars right by the island. I forget what it's called, but basically they both fished the same, exactly the same spot. And this fish came out from that spot between those 3 days every year, like 3 years in a row. There ain't no coincidences. There's always a reason. But the fact that this chap predicted Jacko would catch two-tone on that date, and although he'd already caught it, he may well have been exactly right. Who knows? So that's pretty much it, Mark. We've got one more, haven't we?
We have. We've got one more. That is, well, the first one that was recorded, Steve Briggs.
Well, not really. I can't think of many pranks. I mean, the funniest thing I've seen in years, I mean, Crow won't thank me for this, but it was him falling in at Euro Aqua in Hungary, and it started off, I was fishing with Crowy in one swim, and his mate Chris Felton was fishing a little bit further down the bank, and he'd hooked this fish, and just to his right there was a little bank that sort of jutted out a bit, and it was all reed lined, and this fish had sort of gone cut round the reeds just out of sight and got snagged up. And I mean, it was freezing cold. It was quite late October in Hungary, and it was quite cold. You know, we were sort of wrapped up every day. But anyway, you know, Crowy's gone down to help, and there was a few of us gathered round, and he said, "Well, I've got me waders. I'll get me waders on, wade round the reeds, and see if I can unsnake it for you." So anyway, he's got out just to this little point of the reeds, and we sort of looked at each other, looked round. Crowy's just disappeared. He's literally not there. Bloody hell, where is he? And there's just this line of bubbles coming up, and Crowy's head pops up. And honestly, I've seen other people do it in the same spot. There's this little spot on there, and it must just go down like a skating, you know, like a ski slope. And, yeah, and literally, you get to that corner, he just disappeared. He literally just disappeared. In half a second, he was gone. He bopped up out of the water, and everyone was just falling about on the bank laughing. It was so funny. Poor old Crowy. You know, he was trying to do a good deed and just got soaking wet.
Yeah, we've all fallen in, but it's not bad falling in. What's bad is falling in when people watch you do it.
Yeah, in front of everyone.
Yeah.
And going right under as well. It must have been 10 or 12 foot deep there, you know. None of us knew it. We thought it was just about a foot deep, you know, he just waded around to get the fish. But yeah, no, he disappeared. And last year, we was in another swim, but we was looking down on the same area. And exactly the same thing happened to someone else. They got a fish snag, and I saw the guy walking along to the reeds, and I nudged the bloke next to me. I said, here, look. And before I could finish saying it, it disappeared as well. He'd literally done exactly the same thing. He'd just disappeared and come up coughing and spluttering. But yeah, it's obviously, it's just one of them spots.
Yeah. No, if you're ever there again and you see it happening, grab your camera.
Well, it happened so quick, you know, literally before I could tell the bloke what was going to happen, it had already happened, you know what I mean? It was that quick. But yeah, I'll get the camera ready next time and film it.
So I hope you've all enjoyed these stories from our new group of anglers. That went pretty well, didn't it, Mark? Some good stories in there.
Oh, certainly. I'm kind of like a fanboy myself, just listening to them. I can listen to Adrian Wolf Rays, and I felt quite privileged to have done a lot of the recording.
Yeah, we're getting the best stories from some of the longest serving, you know, biggest name anglers in the country, and it is a privilege, isn't it, to be able to hear firsthand them telling, you know, the things that we read about in magazines, and you know, they are the top of the tree of British carp fishing, and to hear those stories firsthand, it's ace, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant. And you know, I just spent last night, yesterday evening I was sat with Julian Cundiff, who was one of the people who, he published my very first article. Yeah, I've looked up to him forever. And then there's a little bit of you thinks, like, you know, who am I to be, you know, chatting and interviewing these people? But someone's got to do it, and we are.
And we are. So until episode 2, where we'll have the same anglers with another group of questions, till episode 2, we'll see you then.
See you then. Turn on. Okay.